Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 175 of the Garden DC podcast. In this episode, we chat with Caitlin Calogira, a licensed tour guide and author, about the women behind many of Washington, D.C.'s public gardens. The plant profile is on calendula, and we share what's going on in the garden, as well as some upcoming local gardening events in the What's New segment. We close out with the last word on self-sowing plants by Dr. Alan Armitage. This episode, we're joined by Caitlin Calogira. Caitlin's going to talk to us all about Washington, D.C. history and the intersection with female gardeners and female personalities that have woven throughout the city's history over the centuries and past few decades. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here, and I'm so excited to share some women's history at the intersection of gardening with all of you listening.
Yeah, this is going to be exciting. So some of the stories might be familiar to some listeners, some might be new, and we're excited to hear some of those new ones and some of those secrets that, you know, are always poking their heads up out of history that you're like, what? I didn't know that. So that's always a great thing to know. And before we jump into all of that, Caitlin, let's talk a little bit about you and your background in history. And I have to ask, are you personally a gardener?
Well, I guess I'll start with maybe the disappointing news in that I'm not much of a gardener. I appreciate it. I really admire folks who have the time and the patience. It's not something that I've ever really been able to commit to. So maybe it's in my future. But sadly, I wouldn't identify myself as one. I hope I'm still welcome on the podcast.
Of course, of course. We're open to all colors of thumbs. And so I normally ask, were you born with a green thumb? And I'm going to take that as a no. But not all of us were born with green thumbs. And a lot of us developed them later in life. So there is hope for you, Caitlin.
Thank you. I like hope. Yeah. So I guess that's a good transition into the kind of work that I do and where I spend most of my time. I wear a few different hats. I'm self-employed as a Washington, D.C. tour guide. So I always say that the National Mall and the city streets are my office, which, as you can imagine, isn't always green, although I'll show you several places where it is. But I'm mostly used to, you know, loud sirens and cars and crowds of people as a tour guide. But I love the job, and I'm really focused in on all kinds of history around DC, but I focus in on women's history for sure. And I founded my company called A Tour of Her Own in 2018. So I'm a small business owner in the district, and myself and a team of tour guides develop all kinds of tours around women's history. And that's how I really got linked in with, you know, how many women are visible and represented in gardens. So I'm really excited that we could link up and talk about that today. And the third sort of hat that I wear is I am a published author. I co-wrote a book called 111 Places in Women's History That You Must Not Miss in Washington, D.C. And so of those 111 places, there are several gardens and green spaces that women have been involved in. And so I'll be bringing them up during today's session.
Excellent. Can't wait to hear about them. And Caitlin, I know a little bit about DC tour guides in that you just can't, you know, come and put a shingle out and say you're a tour guide, right? You have to have some type of training or certification.
Yeah, there's a certification that goes through the city. So they do a background check on you, and you have to get your license through Washington, D.C. local government. And then beyond that, there are several professional organizations that you can join. A lot of this work is sort of a piece of the gig economy. So we are freelancers. Many of my colleagues are contractors. And so it actually allows a lot of flexibility to create and deliver the kind of tours or commentary that we think our audience will like. So yeah, there's definitely some standards in place, but it's also very broad for us to make this career what we want it to be. And it's also a profession that was once known to be, you know, a bit part-time and secondary, but now a lot of folks do this as their primary full-time job, like myself, and it's really rewarding work.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine you're meeting people from all over the world visiting the Washington, D.C. region. And have you had some crazy requests for custom tours or people generally ask for the same things?
Oh, everything is crazy. Everything is crazy. Actually, you know what? That's funny because it comes from both sides. Certainly, there's clients and guests that want to do some really niche and out of the box experiences, which we really welcome. But then it comes from the tour guide side as well. So my team of tour guides will say, listen, we want to do a tour about this corner of a cemetery from 1780 something. And it's like very bizarre and very specific. And that's what makes it so interesting, primarily with the work that I do, because we appeal to a lot of locals, people that have lived their whole lives and don't want to see the traditional stuff. They want to know the women's stories. They want to know the sort of marginalized histories that aren't represented with major statues and memorials. So we do a lot of that niche out of the box kind of tour experience.
Awesome. And I can see that maybe the research and prepping for some of those custom tours is really interesting.
Absolutely. The research is so much fun. Definitely send you down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Let's start with some of those women-centered gardens in the city that we're familiar with, those of us who are in the Washington, D.C. region. And maybe let's start on the National Mall. I'm thinking of starting at the Capitol and working our way around a little bit. So right at the foot of the U.S. Capitol is the U.S. Botanic Gardens, and in the back of it, kind of to the back, to the side, what would you say? I would say that's the west side, is the First Lady's Water Garden.
Yeah, it's actually, yes, exactly on the west side of the conservatory there in the outdoor space. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, it's called the First Lady's Water Garden. And this, I think, is one of those memorials that is a bit hidden. It's not marked super well. It is recognized if you're somebody that reads all the little words on all the signs. But if you're just sort of strolling through there, you wouldn't recognize that this is actually titled and honoring the First Ladies. But it's a wonderful memorial to our First Ladies all throughout time. And as you stroll through the outdoor area there, it's sort of right in the middle of the gardens, and it's a huge granite fountain. And if you look closely on the fountain, like you really get up in there without falling into the water, but take a look at the detail when you go and visit, because the design on the fountain is based on a colonial quilt pattern that was used by Martha Washington at her home in Mount Vernon. So it's very intentionally designed to honor not only the First Ladies, but their style as well.
Hmm. Yeah, and to me, whenever I come upon it, I think of it as the quilt garden. Like, I don't even think of it really as a water garden, because to me, water garden is, you know, water lilies, lotus, you know, plants, but it is strictly just a water feature. It doesn't have plants in it, but it has that beautiful granite quilt design.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to start calling it the quilt pattern as well. but you're right. Yeah, it is a bit more of a fountain design than it is a water garden, which makes me think about Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens, right? That's mm-hmm. a water garden to me. But this is a little bit more manufactured, but nevertheless beautiful. And it's really the story behind the First Lady's water garden that is so intriguing to me. And it's very timely as well. So if we kind of jump back in time a little bit, I'll take you to the year 2006. So that's when the garden was officially dedicated. Hmm. And at the time, it was who was present there was First Lady Laura Bush. And, you know, she marked this as a tribute to America's most extraordinary women. And she was speaking on behalf of a group, right? Not just herself at the time, but all of the women who have served in this role. And so if you go even further back, right? Because if you're from DC, you know, nothing gets done quickly here. It's not like we snap our fingers and get a memorial. It takes years of fundraising and planning. So it really started in 1994 at what was an event called the National Garden Gala. And this is such a historic moment because at this kickoff event, you had six living first ladies all gathered there together, which doesn't happen that often, mm-mm. you know? Mm-hmm. And there's this beautiful picture of all of them. If you do a search, it's quick to come up. But these women included Hillary Clinton, Barbara Bush, Nancy Reagan, the late Rosalind Carter, who just passed, Betty Ford, and Lady Bird Johnson, who we're going to hopefully talk about later as well, because she was so committed to nature and gardens. And then sadly, the only first lady who was not in attendance was Jackie Kennedy Onassis, because she was in poor health. And actually, she would pass away just a few weeks later. So, you know, just having all these women in the same space is so iconic. And it makes me think of recent events, because at the funeral of First Lady Carter just this week, you know, you had several first ladies in attendance all coming together for this, you know, this sort of sisterhood, right? And just maintaining the role as a collective. And I love that we can talk about their legacy here at a place that isn't so, you know, columns and cement that you see around DC, but is full of beauty and sort of, it's very feminine forward, you know? And so I love taking visitors here. It's such a surprise that a lot of people don't know it's there unless you're really into gardening, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it's just adjacent to the Rose Garden out there, which, you know, it's beautiful at all times of year, and the New American Garden. So U.S. Botanic Garden, we know it for the conservatory and the indoors and that jungle garden in there, but the outside gardens are just as worthy of exploration.
Definitely. Couldn't agree more.
Hmm. So we want to move along the Smithsonian National Mall and some of the women that are associated with some of the outdoor gardens there. And I'm thinking maybe start with Mary Livingston Ripley.
Sure. Yeah. I also really love this area. Again, we think of the National Mall often as being tall monuments and memorials made of marble and cement. And if you really, you know, take the time to explore the corners of the National Mall, you'll find these amazing gardens. And particularly one of my favorite buildings in that space is the Smithsonian Castle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I always like kind of kid with my tourists, like, did you know that DC has a castle? You know, it's not like we're not in Europe here, but people are always kind of, their jaw drops to when they see it. You know, they don't expect it here. But the gardens are fabulous. Have you had a chance to walk through them?
Yeah, actually, the Ripley Gardens are some of my favorites in the entire city. And that's Janet Draper from Smithsonian Gardens is in charge of that one currently. And she just does a masterful job planting it.
Oh, thank you for shouting her out. I actually didn't know her name off the top of my head, but I follow them on social media and they do a good job of really sharing the process behind preserving all the flowers and maintaining it. So yeah, the people behind the gardens are just as, you know, honorable as the women they're named for. So I love that you brought that perspective. Thank you.
Hmm. And so maybe we'll talk a little bit about how that garden happened to be, because a lot of people don't know, it's sitting on top of a street. It's basically a rooftop garden.
Yeah, definitely. It's like on top of, I believe it's three different Smithsonians. You have the Freer and Sackler Gallery, which is primarily Asian art, and you have the African Art Museum there too. So yeah, it's like a rooftop garden. And actually, it was slated to be a parking lot in like the 1970s, as much of, you know, the city is always trying to find parking, right? And it's such a struggle to try to maintain green space. But the woman that we can really thank for, you know, turning it into a garden is a woman named Mary Livingston Ripley. And she was the founder of the Smithsonian Women's Committee in the 1960s. So she was deeply involved with the Smithsonian. Her husband was actually the, I think, the eighth secretary of the Smithsonian. So she, you know, she was in that world. And then in the 1980s, the Women's Committee, which she had founded, added this plaque to honor Mary Livingston Ripley. And if you go to the garden and look for it, it's just along the brick wall on the Jefferson Drive side. Mm-hmm. And it notes her as their founder and their friend. And I think that that's a really beautiful tribute to her.
Mm. Yeah, so interesting. And I was going to say that the Hauptgarten, I think, is the one that's on top of the Freer and Sackler. And that the Ripley kind of runs along between the Hirschhorn and the castle. So it's kind of that edge right there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right there. I would love to see like a like an overview, underview, mm-hmm. like the whole layout of it. But when you're standing in it, it's hard to make sense of it. But what you're saying definitely sounds like that's how it's laid out.
And they're kind of, you know, side by side and connected, you know, through the back or through a pathway. If you could cut through the castle, which you can't currently do because it is closed, sorry to say, for several years of renovations, but otherwise great. So maybe let's move along to talk about Enid Haupt and her contributions.
Yeah, she has actually a few contributions across DC. And that particular garden opened in the late 1980s. And Enid Haupt was born into a very well-established publishing family, and they owned, you know, a bunch of magazines and newspapers. This is one of these facts that I say on tour, and there's a lot of women who are like 30, 40, 50-somethings who get this often, but Enid Haupt was the second editor of 17 Magazine, and 17 Magazine was one of the first nationwide magazines to like focus on teenage girls and like really encourage them to be model workers and citizens, and which is a, you know, kind of like positive body image, things like that. So that 17 Magazine, I remember it as a kid, and I had no idea this woman Enid Haupt was behind it. It's such an interesting fact. Mm-hmm. But then yeah, she really got committed into philanthropy and started investing in horticulture. And when she would build these little gardens across the country, they would become known as Enid's Edens. Enid's Edens, which is so sweet, I think. Really makes me think of like a just like a beautiful oasis. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, she contributed to the Smithsonian to help reimagine this space. And also there is a plaque for her on the Independence Avenue side of the castle, right on the gate there. So even if the castle isn't open, I think you can still see it from the outside if you're walking by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And normally the gates, you know, to the garden are open. It would just be like maybe Christmas or something or some big event that they might be closed off. And so in front of the castle is the Catherine Folger garden or rose garden, it's also called, which I think a lot of people get confused, Caitlin, with the Folger Shakespeare Theater. So when I tell people, oh, have you been to the Folger Garden, they're thinking that side of town.
Yeah. I think you're right. And to be fair, I've been looking myself to see if there was any connections between these families, and I'm not sure if there is. Mm-hmm. I haven't found evidence of that. Do you think that there is at all or no?
Yeah, I have not heard of any. There has to be somewhere, but no. But there's no direct connection that I can see. It just happens to be a similar name.
Yeah, I quite agree. In fact, I haven't actually been able to find all that much information on Catherine Folger. Primarily, my understanding is that that plaque was dedicated to her by her children, which I think is really, really sweet. And they were just a very prominent, you know, Washington family with banking and fundraising and politics. I believe her husband was the ambassador to Belgium at the time. And so I'm not exactly as read up about her, but I would love to know more. And if you have any other kind of quips about her, I'd love to hear them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much about her personally. And I know it was a posthumous donation, so I don't think she was even at the garden itself when it was dedicated or put in at any case.
Well, she is alongside, you know, Hopped and Ripley, so it's a great place to be recognized.
Mm-hmm. And a sweet little spot to put a rose garden. And people coming off the National Mall, if you are familiar with the D.C. National Mall and know where the carousel is, the big historic antique carousel, it's kind of across, right across from that. And, of course, to the side and in front of the castle. So that will kind of orient you there. So let's talk about a little bit off the National Mall, and you had alluded to her before when we were talking about the first ladies, and that's Lady Bird Johnson and the Lady Bird Johnson Park.
Yeah. So gosh, there's so much to say about Lady Bird. I really love to make connections among these women whenever that's possible. So I actually would love to tie her to Enid Hopped, because I mentioned Hopped has a few markers across the city. A secondary one is actually just on the south side of the White House, bordering Constitution Avenue. And there are fountains there, and they're named Hopped Fountains. And this was all part of Lady Bird Johnson's project to beautify the city. So those two women have a connection with these, you know, these fountains. But Lady Bird Johnson, you know, she's known for a lot of different campaigns, but this one that we particularly focus on is the park, which is just on the other side of the Potomac River. So not quite the DC side as people think about it. But just as you cross the river, there's this park. It is actually still in D.C. People think it's Virginia, but it's like right on the border. And it's formerly known as Columbia Island. It was kind of meant to be like a symbolic entrance into the Capitol. And so in 1968, they renamed it to honor the First Lady. We know her as Lady Bird, but her official name is Claudia Alta Taylor. And it was renamed to basically honor her contributions to protecting America's natural beauty and, you know, giving cities a more natural green feel, right? Her legacy really extends outside of DC as well. She's known for planting millions of flowers on National Park Service land. And if you've ever been over to this park in the spring, it is absolutely breathtaking. There are thousands of daffodils, and my favorite, hundreds and hundreds of tulips that bloom. And it's a real secret gem, and you can get there on the Mount Vernon Trail by biking or walking. And I truly love it. Have you had a chance to go over there and see that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I'll sneak away. It's always around the time of the cherry blossom blooms, right? So when you're seeing the beautiful cherry blossoms, I'm always like, okay, I can get over there, and there should be some late tulips or late daffodils and early tulips. And, it's kind of, Park Service calls it the Tulip Library. Sometimes it'll be listed as that. So I'll try to take pictures looking up and across to the Washington Monument.
Yeah, is
always a nice vantage point. But it is a bit of a trek from the closest metro. Like, you know, you're going to be doing some walking. And like you recommended, a bike is not a bad thing either.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It is not metro accessible, which, you know, I'm very pro public transportation, so that's kind of a downer. But at the same time, it also means you're not getting the crowds of people, especially during cherry blossom season. If you want to escape the you know, people down by the tidal basin.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, a little bit of that is good. And maybe we can talk now also about some of that cherry blossom history and how women in history brought those to DC. So I know a lot of people might be familiar with some of the men who introduced the cherry blossom trees and had something to do with it, but you can fill us in, I think, on some of that female-oriented cherry blossom history.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing this up. I've tried to be standing on my platform about this, yelling from the mountaintops every year around cherry blossoms, because there are women behind this effort, and it's so important that they get recognized. In fact, you know, to tie it back to the First Ladies, which is a theme here, First Lady Helen Taft was extremely instrumental in bringing the cherry blossoms to DC. First Lady Taft is also buried over in Arlington National Cemetery. She doesn't get the recognition as much because, you know, the Kennedys are there, but the Tafts are the only other presidential couple there. So you can go over to Lady Bird Park one day and also see First Lady Taft. But yeah, she worked very closely with a woman named Eliza Skidmore, and the two of them were largely responsible for the cherry blossoms. Skidmore was really involved with the National Geographic. I believe she was the first female board member. She was also a photojournalist with them, and she had traveled Japan she was pretty well traveled through Japan and had an idea of how these trees would be able to thrive and exist. And she knew that DC would be a great place for them. But sadly, you know, Eliza Skidmore had campaigned to bring them to DC, and many people did not listen to her for like decades until Helen Taft came and, you know, gave her a platform, and the two women helped plant those trees at the dedication. I believe it was the prime minister's wife from Japan as well was on site ceremonially, and also just advocating to bring these trees to the United States. And they serve as a symbol of our friendship with Japan. And all throughout time, women have found their way into this story, even in the 1940s. And so when they were going to chop some of those trees down to build the Jefferson Memorial, there were a lot of women, one of them, Sissy Patterson, who were handcuffing themselves to save the trees. So I love the cherry blossoms. Women are certainly centered. And I hope that if you're listening to this, you just echo that to everyone that talks about the cherry blossoms this year, because I would love nothing more than for a plaque commemorating Eliza Skidmore and her efforts here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, next time I go to Arlington, I'll have to look out for the Taft's burial site, because I did not know that they were there. That's good to know.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a bit outside of the DC central area. And that's a kind of newer garden. That's Wangari, and I'm gonna say it wrong, Matea or Matea Gardens.
I believe it's Matai, but uh-huh. I also have not been able to nail down the exact pronunciation, to be fair. So we're in the same boat with that.
Mm-hmm. I always just say Wangari.
Yeah, same.
makes it a little easier. So what can you tell me about that garden? I'm not as familiar with that one. I think I visited it once when they were doing a weeding day, because they had they do some open community days where you can come in and help out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is very community forward. It's actually not too far from where I used to live, which is why I think I'm a little bit more well visited to this one than the average Washingtonian, but Wangari Gardens is wonderful. I also love to refer to her as Wangari because I feel like after telling her story, she's a friend, but I also want to show her respect because she is a doctor, Dr. Matai, and she was the first African woman to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. This woman, I don't know how her name exactly landed on a small garden in the Parkview neighborhood, but it's fabulous, and I just love it. This community garden, it was founded by like two DC locals who I think were just basically like in education and agriculture fields, and they wanted to mobilize members of their neighborhood to take ownership of this land, which was kind of abandoned. And so collectively they cultivated the land, and now there are individual farming plots that folks in the neighborhood can, I think they rent them out, and you know, however the collective works. But it's a neat little place. And the founders felt like this sort of urban farming, urban landscape idea that they were working with resembled the work of Wangari Maathai. So that's why they named it for her. And I'll tell you a little bit about her background, which is just so impressive. She was an internationally renowned biologist and definitely committed to environmental activism and really building sustainable ecosystems. And she's known for being the founder of the Green Belt Movement. And in 1977, she started this movement to address the needs of women in rural Kenya. And these women and their communities were facing food insecurities, and that was mostly due to like overdevelopment of land, right? And created a scarcity of resources like firewood and water. So what Dr. Maathai did was she provided a monetary stipend to these women in rural Kenya. And what they did with that stipend was plant seeds and grow trees. And so this whole initiative really, and it empowered women economically, and it helped create this sustainable ecosystem that would give communities, you know, better access to cooking and meals or participation in trade and building infrastructures for shelter or fences and things like that. And so, yeah, Wangari is such an amazing, you know, woman. She, I think, over the course of this whole movement, they planted millions and millions of trees, like 20 million trees. And her whole like career was based on the intersection of sustainable environmentalism and biology and women. And she felt like if you put those two things together, that anything is possible. And then she proved it in rural Kenya with her Nobel Peace Prize. And now in little old Parkview, we have this beautiful community space memorializing her. And I think it's just really special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, such a worthy person to name that park after. And it does have like shared fruit trees. I remember that. So anybody can go and glean or pick off the fruit trees. Those are open to everybody. And for those who are familiar with Washington, D.C., to orient where it is, it's just north of Howard University and kind of in the shadow of Children's Hospital. Like that's mm-hmm. that's the neighborhood point where I always think of is always like it's by Children's Hospital, and people yeah. know what you're talking about when you say
that's
that.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So a bit north of the National Mall, but you know, it's accessible by metro and by bus. So in a really easily walkable neighborhood.
Yeah, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that they have community events, like I talked about the gleaning and the days, but I've heard of, you know, poetry readings and yoga there too. So an open and welcoming space for all.
Yes, and we love that here in DC.
Mm-hmm. So kind of the opposite, I don't want to say a closed space, but, you know, a little more harder for people to access is Dumbarton Oaks, in that it's in Georgetown. Everybody complains about there's no parking. As soon as I say, let's go to Dumbarton Oaks, they're like, ah, there's no parking there. And there's no close by metro. I usually go to DuPont Circle and walk up P Street or take a bus up. Mm-hmm. So that makes it more accessible for me, being car free. But it is also owned currently by Harvard University and has a museum on the site. So the grounds and the garden almost get treated as secondary for the public access, because it's considered, you know, a research and a collection of Harvard University. But let's talk about those women who created the gardens there.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that fact. I actually did not know it was owned by Harvard. I think I was under the impression it was the National Park Service. So you definitely taught me something. And, you know, I love learning on podcasts. So
yeah. Thanks for that. And it's true that there's part of Dumbarton Oaks Park that is under National Park Service. So what was the original property? About 2/3 is now cut off from Dumbarton Oaks that Harvard owns. So I would consider like everything downhill and towards Rock Creek Park, that's part of National Parks, and you're correct, it's under that. But the everything that's around the house and grounds and has that wall around it, that's Harvard University property.
Wow. Okay, that's fascinating. You're going to send me down a rabbit hole later trying to figure out how Harvard got this. But yeah, so thanks for that. Yeah, there's definitely some women focused here at Dumbarton Oaks Park. Really, really special women. I'll start with the sort of mastermind behind the park, which is a woman named Beatrix Jones Ferrand. And I feel like anyone that's in the gardening space probably has heard of her before. But she is the first female landscape architect in the United States. And she was the only female founding member of the American Society of Landscape Architects. She's like the real deal. So she created this park, and she did it in partnership essentially with a woman named Mildred Bliss, who purchased Dumbarton Oaks with her husband in like the 1920s. And so Mildred hired Beatrix, and from there Ferrand designed. There's a couple different elements. There's like a formal flower garden, as well as a adjoining park. Mm-hmm. So the two of them sort of like worked in partnership over several decades, and they became really, really good friends. Do you happen to know what their nickname was? This is my favorite.
No, I've read some of the letters between the two, but I don't recall a nickname.
I believe they called themselves, this is not even a nickname other people gave them, they called themselves the Gardening Twins.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the Gardening Twins. But you're right, they exchanged all these letters with each other, and I think some drawings as well. But yeah, it really speaks to the power of this friendship, this partnership. To build a park, it's like, I think it's just about 30 acres or so. It is massive, and it's like you are totally lost in this space. And if you are someone that like wants to get out of the city, you can just go here and you feel like you're in the country, you know? And I think that's really how she wanted it to be. That's how she designed it. And it's a place that you can spend quite a bit of time at walking around. And it's really special. But just as you had mentioned earlier, yeah, it's not entirely accessible, not only by public transportation, but you often have to get tickets for it, primarily in the summer. So it takes a little bit of planning, but it is well, well worth it.
Yeah. And unfortunately, and kind of fortunately, it's gotten really popular on social media to take selfies and go to DeMartin Oaks because it has so many famous little grottos and places to pose. So they're limiting the ticket availability. I think you can only order it online and in advance now to attend or to go there. So definitely try to get your tickets in advance. They're not expensive and they're not rare, but you just can't like show up and walk in now and pay at the door.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. I think popularity, you know, has its good points, but it also, when you get a little too popular, then they have to start limiting the access a bit for people just so everybody can have a good experience while they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You want to maintain that sort of serenity and peacefulness, especially right when you're going through gardens. I think if you're in like a museum, it's different, you know, there can be people everywhere, but in a garden you really want to be able to sit with your solitude and your thoughts and, you know, take in the space. So I respect that. I understand and I respect it.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about some of those other hidden spots in the city that you enjoy visiting. Are there any like secret spots that you bring your tour goers to?
Ooh, well, I'll bring up this one spot because I know you and I had threw the idea back and forth about talking about it. Hillwood Estate is just my absolute favorite. Again, I used to live sort of up in that Northwest area for most of my time in DC over the last 10 years. And Hillwood became one of my escape places, primarily, you know, during the pandemic when everyone was just really embracing the outdoors. Hillwood Estate, for me, ties in so many of my passions. It's not only the beautiful outdoor gardens, right? Like the Japanese garden, and there's even a little pet cemetery garden over there. But the greenhouse as well is like so wonderful. I love seeing the orchids in there. And then it ties with women's history, right? Marjorie Meriwether Post was the CEO of Post Cereal. And that woman, wow, her legacy is really something. Her mansion and her house is just incredible. It's both a place where you can be in awe of everything that's so grand and expensive and cultural and worldly, but you can also go lay in the grass and just look at the sky. The ticket price is a suggested ticket price. You can go in there and spend a few bucks, or you can go have a whole day and go to the cafe and get a drink and some food. So for me, it's a place that I love and go to personally, but also I will bring the groups of tourists that I have that are closest to me, that really are looking for that unique experience and they don't want to be, you know, on the National Mall. So that's kind of my secret place that I'll take them if they're looking for something different.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that garden is a jewel in Northwest Washington. It's very close to a lot of the Embassy Gardens and American U and that side of town. So you really get a peaceful day, and it's something you want to spend, you know, probably at least 2 or 3 hours at. You're not going to just run through Hillwood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So how can our listeners contact you if they wanted to book you or one of your guides for a tour or learn more about your book or business?
Well, thank you for asking. The first thing that we do is direct everybody to our website, www.atourofherown.com. And we encourage you to sign up for our email list. So just about all things go through email. That includes updates about public events, as well as any special articles, blogs, reflections that we have. We have a membership model that I encourage folks to look into. And our programming is very accessible for everybody. So even if you're not in the DC area, you can still participate. Every month we do a live walking tour in DC, and then we also do 2 virtual programs. So 1 virtual tour and then a virtual book talk. So starting January, we once a month go through 10 chapters of the book, and then by October of next year, we will have finished the entire book in total altogether. And it's just a really great hour a month where we can share our perspective, our behind the scenes, and really dive into some of these women's stories. And beyond that, we're always available for public tours. So if you have a group, a lot of corporate groups or universities are interested in kind of doing something different, or if you're just coming with your family or you're a local and you want to go explore, we'll make it happen for you. So check out our website and send us an email. I'd love to know what you thought about this podcast. I always want to know what is special and intriguing for you. So go over to our website, and thank you so much for listening to me today.
And thank you, Caitlin, for sharing that and your research and your passion for women in history, and especially that connection to our local DC gardens. And for those listeners who are way outside of the DC region, and I know we have some international listeners and those, you know, across the country in the USA, I welcome you to come and visit DC, and not just when the cherry blossoms are blooming, right, Caitlin?
Right.
So much more to offer as far as gardens and touring outside of those couple of weeks in spring. And I actually will say that October is probably the ideal time of year to visit DC, and the gardens are spectacular as well. Then what do you think for timing, Caitlin?
I could not agree with you more. October, maybe November. It is, the weather is perfect. The crowds are small, and it's such a lovely time to be here.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, Caitlin.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathy. I really appreciate it.
Calendula plant profile. Calendula, Calendula officinalis, is also known as pot marigold or poet's marigold. It is a half-hardy perennial plant that readily reseeds itself. It is hardy to USDA zones 2 to 11. Planted in full sun and in well-draining loamy soil. Water only during periods of drought. Deadhead it frequently to encourage continual blooming. Calendula is also a long-lasting cut flower. You should occasionally weed around the plant and carefully pull out any new seedlings to pot them up and pass them on to other gardeners. It was named Herb of the Year in 2008, as it is both edible and beneficial. Snip off the colorful ends of the flower petals to add a pretty accent to any salad or as a decoration on baked goods. It has a very light taste, like a spicy pale honey. The dried petals can be used to color broths, cheeses, and butters. It's a thrifty substitute for the much more expensive saffron spice. Calendula tends to sulk in the summer heat here in mid-Atlantic USA, but that's just a pause in its robust routine. In my garden plot, I can't recall any month of the year that it doesn't have a few blooms opening up. This is a tremendous workhorse that belongs in every edible and cutting garden. Calendula, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, we got hit by some real freezes here in the Washington, D.C. area. So the annuals that were still persisting all the way through fall have now been knocked back. And in my community garden plot, I'm down to just some kale, radishes, and a few of the greens. The November 2023 issue of Washington Gardener magazine is out and online. You can check it out at our website, washingtongardener.blogspot.com. The cover story is on the messy and marvelous sweet gum tree. Also included are stories on the USDA's new plant hardiness zone map, attracting dark-eyed juncos, meet Miss Flora Bunda, a butterfly pea cocktail recipe, how to grow collards, a cold hardy green, how to plant trees properly to prevent ambrosia beetles, a visit to Paxson Hill Farm, and much more. In the local gardening world, some events you might want to attend include the Tudor Place celebration of Christmas Pass, and that includes a holiday tea and tour on December 3rd, Tudor Lights on December 7th, and candlelight tours on December 8th, 13th, and 15th. You can find out more about those at tudorplace.org, and Tudor Place is in Georgetown neighborhood of Washington, D.C. And the Chesapeake Conservation Landscaping Council is having its 10th annual Turning a New Leaf Sustainable Landscaping Conference. And that includes speakers like friend of the podcast, Abra Lee, and pollinator conservationist Heather Holm. That is on Thursday, December 7th at Chesapeake Bay Beach Club in Stevensonville, Maryland. For more information and to register for that, you can go to chesapeakelandscape.org/turning-a-new-leaf-conference and check it out. And also, underneath the Haupt Garden on the National Mall is a new Smithsonian Gardens exhibit called Human Nature. We'll be telling you more about that in our December issue of Washington Gardener magazine, but meanwhile, you can go downstairs in either the Freer or the Sackler Gallery and find the hall and check out that exhibit on your own. Happy gardening!
Hey there, garden lovers. This is Ray Eaton, founder of Discover Garden Tours. I'm here to invite you all to join us next April and experience the beauty of Dutch gardening and horticulture on our Discover the Netherlands tour. Please join us and speaker, author, and social media influencer Kathy Gents for this once-in-a-lifetime garden adventure. We'll visit private and public gardens, flower shows and auctions, and much, much more. Highlights include the Kuchenhof Gardens, Hortus Botanicus Leiden, and the Flora Holland Flower Auction. The tour dates are from April 16th through April 25th, 2024. Full details and registration are available on our website at discoverourtours.com. Remember, space is limited, so if you don't want to miss out, I would highly recommend signing up today. We look forward to seeing you in the Netherlands and sharing this unforgettable journey together.
In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Gents and Terry Spite, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space, while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. The Urban Garden, 101 Ways to Grow Food and Beauty in the City, comes out this spring. You can pre-order it now at Amazon.com and bookshop.org. Get low-maintenance alternative to lawns with the new book, Ground Cover Revolution, by Kathy Gents. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in homeownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional, everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape, and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal of the perfect lawn is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Quarto.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30.
Well, good day, everybody. It's Dr. A back in the garden with my last word on self-sowing plants. Now, these are plants that just leave them alone, and all of a sudden, next year or next month, you may see some seedlings come up, which can be a good thing and perhaps not so good thing. I'm a gardener, and I just detest these compounds and chemicals that people throw out so that they can keep seedlings of weeds from germinating. There they go under a bunch of names, but if you put those out in the spring, you're fooling yourself to think that you're keeping all seeds away and you won't have to weed as much and yada yada. It's a disaster because not only are you keeping, I suppose, those pigweeds and clovers and other things out, but you're also keeping spectacular plants that want to resow and you don't do any work. So I certainly do not recommend pre-emergent chemicals. What do I keep? Oh my goodness. Well, I live in an area where, for example, I look forward to larkspur every spring. I mean, in the late fall, well, even early winter, I see seedlings. And oh my goodness, in May, I have a garden full of larkspur. I don't do anything. The insects love it. The pollinators love it. I love it. I can cut it for a bouquet for, you know, just overnight or for a few days. It's spectacular. Or poppies. I mean, I don't do anything. I just leave them reseed. And these poppies and larkspur and celosia and nigella and even hellebores will reseed. Columbines will reseed to get all these. Oh, they're so promiscuous. You never know what you're going to get when you throw a bunch of columbines in the garden. So those are the things I leave. And for sure, I get a ton of weeds that come up. Violets are the bane of my garden. I got violets everywhere. But heck, if you're anything like me, getting out there and weeding a little bit is actually quite pleasant. I feel like I've done something, got a little exercise, and I've gotten rid of those suckers. You know, there's a ton of other weeds that come up too, and I get it. I just think that there's so many plants in our garden that give us so much pleasure for so little work. Why would we want to mess with it? So those are some of the things I leave. Those are some of the great, great pleasures I receive from these plants that are self-sowers. This is Dr. A, and goodness gracious, that is my last word on plants that take care of themselves.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/GardenDC. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.blogspot.com. thank you. You can find and follow Washington Gardener on Twitter / X, Instagram, and Pinterest at WDC Gardener, and on Facebook at Washington Gardener Magazine. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Spotify and Apple. Open the Spotify or Apple app, search for Garden DC, check on the rate button, and select 5 stars.